Anybody else on this topic?
I have a question of Alan's.
Okay.
Bypassed Alan. Don't want you to feel like you neglected Alan. In your review that you submitted, your pre-filed testimony, if you will, your review, you state that with reference to the applicant's analysis, you state the entirety of the analysis and submission by the applicant is absent any expert analysis, conclusive facts, mere facts, depth of reasoning, or rationale or objective standard upon which to base a precedent of finding. And I want to put those very specific words in context. As compared to other scenic analyses that you have had the opportunity to review, is this indicative, in your view, of most scenic analysis, or is this specific to this scenic analysis?
Let me start with an explanation and or an apology on that particular clause. I wrote that clause in the context of Kibby Stream, which was the first one that I looked at. And as I was doing my final editing, I moved that clause up to the introductory paragraph. My intent when I was drafting it was to have it apply to Kibby Stream. My recollection was that at the time, in the application, the analysis of Kibby Stream, new statutory standard, designated scenic resource, the analysis of the impact on Kibby Stream was, frankly, a few sentences. So my frustration reviewing the application was that some scenic assets at the point of application were analyzed with a few sentences rather than more rigor. So my apologies to Ms. Vissering that the blanket accusation was first drafted not toward the entirety of her work product, but rather toward Kibby Stream. I do think that since those comments were drafted, I've been impressed by the quality and quantity of additional information submitted. I think that's when I talk about precedent, I think my expectation is that if the legislature is going to list some assets as scenic, then the applicant has the burden to describe with some level of appropriate rigor the impact on those assets. And I think the applicant has come a long way in recent submissions in giving you a lot more material for you to review, you to make your ultimate conclusion.
So at this point, as the information stands in the record, how would you characterize this analysis, this scenic analysis?
I think that others have characterized it, and I'm not sure that I want to give a summary characterization. I think that there is a lot more quality information for you to review. I think there are still some factual errors, some of which are important, both by Ms. Vissering and others, that somebody needs to sort through because it can get confusing. I think that Lurk's consultant made some characterizations of some of the material that was on the record at the time, and some of those characterizations, I'll let you look at his wording, but I think that again, through this process, there's actually two things. I think you're putting the applicant in an unfair position because there's a new law, and it's not really clear what Lurk wants. There isn't much guidance for applicants in terms of whether what the methodology should be, let alone the rigor of the methodology. So that's some of what I want to put people through their paces, including this commission, to say what you want, because I don't want to characterize it negatively if you're getting something that you feel is sufficient.
Would you suggest that we halt this proceeding and move to rulemaking on scenic character?
No. That's not my position to make that suggestion, and I defer to others. I think that Lurk staff suggested to me, I'm just blanking on the consultant's name, the Jim Palmer. LIRC staff suggested to me that Jim Palmer's work product was their goal to start to set the stage of expectations, start to set the stage of methodology. And my guess is that had Jim Palmer's work product been available to this applicant when the applicant filed, then they would have said, oh, that's what LIRC's consultant is looking for. Let's meet his expectations rather than some other undefined expectations. I need to be blunt. You know, a lot of this, LIRC reminds me that you as a commission have struggled with this for years. So I don't want to presume that I have the answer when you have struggled with this for years. But just when I'm starting to look at other, you know, DEP seems as, or there's some similar, if not identical, issues at DEP. But I don't want to, as I said, I don't want to create issues where DEP or LIRC are comfortable. But if I don't know what the precedent is, then I don't know how to help you.
Have you had an opportunity? I know you've had the opportunity, but specifically, I'm talking about the Plum Creek decision, and specifically the scenic character analysis that was undertaken there. It was a long process of collaboration between LIRC staff, LIRC consultants, Plum Creek staff, and Plum Creek consultants, as well as a number of interveners, that resulted in what we, at least at the time, this was in November, felt was a fairly clear statement of how we would approach scenic standard vista analysis. And I was just wondering if you had any specific comments on that document.
I did not review that in detail because I was up to my neck in other issues with Plum Creek, so I took a pass on scenic. And also, I think your staff was rigorously engaged in that process, and that's one question. I was very impressed with the staff engagement in the Plum Creek process and the commission's engagement, and I think that level of dialogue can bring a lot of clarity to the wind power process.
Okay, thank you.
I think this is a topic we could spend a lot of time on. And I guess what would be most helpful, and I'm very concerned, I think we're all concerned about it, particularly from your perspective, and I think what would be most helpful for us maybe is to know what are the questions you have or what are the concerns that you have, because I'm assuming that your concerns have to do primarily with lands that are under your ownership, BPL's ownership, and water bodies, parks. Am I correct, or?
Yeah, but it's really hard to go landowner by landowner in terms of scenic impact. So some level, I want to know what the law is for everybody or what the law is for the applicant.
Well, in the Wind Power Act, we're particularly interested in state and federal significant sites, the water body, the Arnold Trail.
The reason, I've taken a pass on many wind power applications, even if they've had some level of jurisdictional visibility from a Bureau asset or from other assets. I've just taken a pass because, in my mind, I wasn't worried about the precedent of LIRC taking a pass, so to speak, on those assets, those impacts. This application, this project, the combination of the internationally significant Arnold Trail on just about the exact same geography as the scenic byway, on just about the same geography as Bureau land, on just about the same geography as an outstanding scenic pond, that collision of four scenic assets listed in statute all together in one place of geography, I don't think you should be comfortable doing this to figure out whether it's reasonable or unreasonable. I think there should be some level of, oh, this is a big one. Four significant assets all in the same parcel. How do we approach it? And that's what I tried to ask is, okay, how do I approach it? I make a conclusion, or can I help you make a conclusion?
I think we're, and I'm maybe speaking out of line, but for me, I'm looking for some guidance from you as the state agency that oversees.
So my most specific thing, I think if I could summarize where I am right now, I've watched the back and forth between the Maine Historic Preservation Commission, the Maine Arnold Trail, we have historic sites. We think of ourselves as, to a certain extent, a guardian of the Arnold Trail. The Maine Historic Preservation Commission said adverse effect. Gene Vissering said, quote, no evidence to suggest compromise of historic experience. I went back. Maine Historic Preservation again said no adverse effect. Jim Palmer said, this resource not designated for visual purposes. Maine Historic Preservation cites chapter and verse of federal law on why the visual impact from the historic trail is very important to them. So that back and forth in the testimony of the Arnold Trail being the clearly national significant, if not international significant, you know, so the, and I would say in this application, the primary sort of, if you can't deal with the deal with the Arnold Trail first and the other scenic issues come second. So that back and forth of factual analysis or legal analysis or historic analysis, I think that the record has a lot of mixed messages from different parties. My plan was to sort out my own thoughts in writing before today. I had other matters this weekend, so I didn't get to that, but at some point I do plan to give to LIRC staff sort of what I just gave you in terms of my effort to follow the back and forth. Then on a legal matter, Maine Historic Preservation says adverse effect. It's on the record. It's in your record. It's Maine Historic Preservation. It's our trail to a certain extent in some places that we are managing. Your legal standard is unreasonable adverse effect. So good luck. You have to decide whether a finding of adverse effect, in fact, is an unreasonable adverse effect, and we can play with words forever to help you make that determination. And then the thing that I've been frustrated with from the beginning is I like mitigation. I used to do mitigation. I don't think there need to be black and white decisions of dancing on a head of a pin of unreasonableness. The federal government allows mitigation. A finding of adverse effect is not a rejection. It is the starting point for discussion of mitigation. The Attorney General and I have had some discussions, and good luck with that. And then we bring in tangible benefits. Let's look frankly at tangible benefits, that if that's the sort of hear no evil, see no evil mitigation, then let's really look at tangible benefits and say, are the people of Maine being made whole? Are the impacts being quasi-mitigated through your decision, your guidance on tangible benefits, not whatever checks the applicant has put on the table for you to respond to or not.
That was helpful. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? We move on. Molly, I guess I'm not skipping over anybody here, am I?
Maybe it'll be easier to get this one down. I don't know. This one's not pretty. Hi, I'm Molly Dougherty, with the director of the Maine Natural Areas Program. Our program has jurisdiction over rare, threatened, and endangered plants in the state of Maine, as well as rare and exemplary natural communities and ecosystems. We track the status and trends. We're here today because of our concerns regarding the proposed development's impacts on our features. And there was one other concern I wanted to bring to the table, which is that since we were asked to comment on the proposed project, we've also been asked to comment on a proposed expansion of the expedited area that actually abuts this project. And I just have a little bit of a concern that we're not kind of doing things piecemeal, but that we actually have a vision for what the project will be on this ridgetop or not. So that's another concern.
What specific concerns might you have with this particular project?
With this particular project as filed, there is an impact to a rare natural community, a subalpine community up on the ridgetop.
Do you believe that there's an undue adverse effect on that community?
I think there's no question there's an adverse impact. It's been Today I actually heard 102 acres, which I think we calculated less, but that would be about a 28% reduction in the natural community that's up on the top of the ridge. For me, when I start thinking about your terminology with unreasonable, I don't know if you want to take each natural feature independently, but be looking a little bit more collectively. And so there's a natural community up there. There's also bicknose thrush habitat, and there may be other biological values as well. And so I would say I'm not going to speak just to that natural community, but there's definitely an adverse impact. This question of unreasonable really is up for you to determine what that litmus test is.
I'm Jay Clement with the Army Corps of Engineers, the token Fed at the table, but I'm here at Marsha's request not to express concerns for the project. We have an independent process for that, but to answer any questions that you may have regarding my process and specifically the Historic Preservation Act.
Questions? I'm trying to think. We had a conversation.
Marsha. I was going to simply ask Jay to explain the nature of the process between the Corps and the Historic Preservation Commission so that you'd have the benefit of understanding. I think Alan did a good segue into that when he talked about there being the finding of undue adverse impact, and then that leads into a mitigation process. And I thought Jay he explained to me back in November how that process worked, and I thought it might be useful for you to understand that that is going on too. So perhaps Jay could just give you a brief summary.
Sure.
If you briefly could explain that.
Just as general background, the National Environmental Policy Act requires the federal action agencies, be it permitting agencies or funding agencies, to comply with a host of core laws, including Endangered Species Act, Historic Preservation Act, Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, et cetera, et cetera. And we, as the permitting agency here, are that action agency, so we have to coordinate directly with the Maine Historic Preservation Office pursuant to Section 106 of the Historic Preservation Act. The way that that works is much like the Clean Water Act or Natural Resources Protection Act, the wetlands regulations, if you will. We look at avoiding and minimizing impacts to historic resources, and if there are unavoidable impacts to historic resources, then we look to guidance from MHPC and Maine's Indian tribes to tell us whether there are adverse impacts or potentially adverse impacts. But regardless, if there are unavoidable impacts, then we move to compensation or mitigation. And at that point, it essentially becomes an open book as to what form that mitigation may take. There are some precise things in regulations that speak to, say, recording the importance and the value of the resource in perpetuity. For example, if a bridge is scheduled to be removed or demolished by Maine DOT, there may be a photo recordation session of that bridge or of a dam that has to be removed or what have you. And then there are very precise regulations and requirements that have to be by which that recordation occurs. And then the record is maintained by MHPC in perpetuity or by the archives or whoever in perpetuity. But it can be many other things, too. We have precedent for this in the form of the Oakfield Wind Project, where, again, MHPC has determined that there will be adverse impacts to a series of historic farmsteads that are several miles away from that particular project. And MHPC is advocating for a very broad documentation itemization of historic properties in and around that area of Arista County. It's a very wide search that the applicant is prepared to commit to and provide documentation. It's, if you will, I guess, again, a categorization of where these sites are located, there's photo documentation that goes with it and various narratives. So, again, it can be an open book as to what constitutes suitable mitigation in the rare event, at least in my experience, that MHPC determines that the impacts cannot be mitigated, then the Corps, as the decision agency, makes a decision, do we issue a permit above and beyond those concerns, or do we deny the permit? In most cases, we are reluctant to go against what we believe is the expert for that particular resource, MHPC, and by association, the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation in Washington. So it would be, I think the expectation would be that we'd have difficulty issuing a permit if there were unmitigatable impacts. The other thing I'll mention, you know, we have mitigation, but we can also have project modification. Some you've heard today proposals to reduce the size of the project in order to address A, B, C concern. Well, similar things can be applied to historic resources. Perhaps there's a way to modify the project to reduce the impact to an acceptable level with MHPC, but we haven't gone there yet. So at this point in our process, we are aware of the coordination that's gone on between the applicant and MHPC. We've sanctioned it. In fact, we've requested it. And at some point in the very near future, we will be stepping in to work with MHPC and the applicant to hopefully mediate an option for mitigation or figure out what the next steps are from there. So if you have any questions about that process, I'll answer them now.
I think that's good.
Yeah, one other point because I know Marcia brought this up. And what does the commission do with regards to this particular aspect of things? Well, I can only point you to the example that I know, and that's the DEP. They deal with similar issues regularly, and quite often I find that they will defer to the Corps process. I'm not saying that's the easy way out, but it seems to answer their obligations, and I'm not suggesting you do the same. But it may be an option for you. Our process will continue. We will bring resolution to it in one way or another. And I can't tell you what the timetable is relative to the decisions that you have to make. But we do have a process, and we will see it through to the end.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I guess, Jim?
My major concern.
Can you just state your name? I don't know if I've been getting everybody to do that, but.
James Palmer, and I'm Lurk's scenic expert. My major concern has been to make sense out of the Wind Power Act, a lot of which deals with new ways of thinking about the scenic impacts and scenic impacts that are no longer relevant. So, for instance, whether or not you can see the lights from the Bigelow Range is irrelevant now by statute. It's past 8 miles. We have a new criteria, unreasonable. I couldn't find anything in Maine's court record that seemed to relate to help define what unreasonable means compared to undue. I'm interested about the specific scenic resources that the Act has defined and how we actually interpret that, and things that either don't make sense to me in those designations. For instance, why it's only pullouts on scenic roads. It's not the pullouts that are designated, it's the road. So we've been talking about a scenic byway. That's irrelevant, according to the Act. The only thing that's relevant is the two pullouts. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but that is what the Act says. I'm concerned about some of the evaluation criteria. The Act talks to us about significant scenic resources, and then I assume everything else is a non-significant resource, whether it's scenic or not. And one of the evaluation criterion is significance. At one level, the answer to that is yes or no. But at another level, there may be lots of levels of significance, and the Act doesn't give us any indication of that. And I think in my report, I gave some suggestions what that might be. So, for instance, the Arnold Trail doesn't really talk about scenic quality, and I can't believe that the Arnold Expedition was really worried a whole lot about scenic quality, as they were making an extremely important military event occur. Just because we need to designate it historically as a major battle event, and it's worthy of recognition for that, doesn't mean it's scenic. However, we, by the Act, have deemed everything on the list is going to be a scenic resource. Well, maybe it's a low-quality scenic resource, even though it's a scenic resource, simply because scenery is not a part of its designation. I don't know. That's got to be worked out. I'm very concerned about cumulative impacts. This project highlights that. I talked to you about Plum Creek, about cumulative impacts. In that case, I came down on the side that we should concentrate impacts on a few lakes, try to get impacts off of lakes, but if we're going to do it on lakes, on a few lakes, keep as many lakes untouched as we possibly can. I haven't had an opportunity to work that through for wind power projects, but in some ways, the logic holds. Rather than distribute projects throughout the state, it seems to me that it would be, from a scenic point of view, a whole lot better if we concentrated those projects in places where they're going to have the least impact. But if we do this incrementally, we're never going to know. You know, it basically means who comes up first, who gets in line first, and that may not be the best place. I'm also concerned that we don't get in a sort of bidding war with DEP jurisdiction, that, you know, rather than look at where the best places for wind projects, developers look at where's the easiest place to get your project permitted. That would be a horrible situation, that it'd have long-lasting effects. And so it seems to me to be really helpful as we clarify all these questions from the Wind Power Act, that we coordinate that with DEP and come to a common understanding, because they have exactly the same criteria. It's not like other development where the criteria are different between the two groups. I'd really like to see visual mitigation be visual. Typically, visual mitigation, well, frequently, visual mitigation isn't visual. It's spending money on something else, like protecting habitat for another species. If we can accept the visual impact, then let's just accept it. If it's important enough to do something about it, then let's do something about it. That's probably enough.
Jim, would you recommend that we place a moratorium on wind power projects until we've addressed, stop, and either go to into a regulation development mode with regard to scenic impacts, or seek sort of legislative clarification?
Yeah, that's a really difficult question for me to answer. The reason is, I mean, I'm not from Maine. I love working here, and I love working with you. It's pretty clear the legislature, I mean, it's an emergency act. They said, let's get going, guys. And you're already behind as a state. You're sort of behind their targets. I don't have a clear understanding, actually, of the relationship between the independence of the LIRC board and the legislature and how that tension might play out. Maybe it just all happens together. Somehow, though, I think we have to start working now on clarifying these issues so that we don't wind up, you know, permitting a dozen projects or more under one set of criteria, and then we say, oh, again, we're going to change the rules on you guys. That's just not fair. I mean, maybe it is appropriate, but we're, you know, the clock's running.
Let's turn, if we might, to the specific application before us as well. I mean, Alan Stern's characterized your report as being based on partial information, that the total information was not available to you as it was not available to him, as he has seen the bulk of that information since his initial review, he's changed his mind. I'm wondering, do you want to amend your report that you submitted in your pre-trial testimony in any way to reflect changes in information that have come before you?
I really haven't seen much update. I made actually a note to ask Marcia about what the updates really were. I saw a response from Gene Vissering, I think, to Alan's comments, but other than that, I'm not quite sure what the additional information is.
I'm sure Alan could tell you at some point. I mean, perhaps not in this venue.
There certainly was incomplete information, and as far as I know, there's still incomplete information, and I expect for a long time there will be incomplete information because the Act wants us to focus on how the scenic environment affects different kinds of users, to pay attention to what their expectation is, to pay attention to the numbers of users and the duration of the exposure. There aren't very many impact assessments that I've ever seen that do that. You know, those are all recognized as logical, important parts of what should be considered, but there's not existing data on that. There's not like a digital elevation model you can put in a GIS. You'd have to develop that each time.
I didn't see that as a conclusion in your report, though. Did I miss that?
Maybe. I can't say for sure tell you the
truth.
Could you
summarize the conclusion of your report with regard to scenic impact of this project?
I think that in relation to this project, I think that actually Gene did a reasonable job. The most important parts are the simulations. I think give you a good sense of what these turbines are going to look like. I think they're accurate. I disagree a little bit with their visibility analysis, but in the bottom line, it's not going to be important. So, I would use those. I mean, what's important is there's a large part of chain of ponds where you're going to see turbines. So those sort of technical aspects, I don't have a big problem with what she did. I think that the information could have been presented better. I've certainly seen work that Gene writes well, and I've seen work written better, more clearly. But I'm assuming that it's because we don't know how to handle all these new criterion stuff, and she struggled like I did.
Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Real quick, what would be your idea of visual mitigation?
Well, one visual mitigation is getting rid of the southern towers. That would help. I mean, relocation, screening, changing behavior. If I'm upset by these wind towers, for instance, then I would just paddle along the eastern shore of Chain of Ponds. I mean, this is not a big decision. My expectation is that actually the behavior is that as you're paddling or fishing, you're not going to be looking at 90 degrees at these wind turbines a whole lot, especially if they bother you. You're going to redirect your behavior so that you have the kind of experience you have. I also think a lot of people are going to be fascinated by it and how they come into and out of view. But that's not to say there aren't people who are going to be really upset and angry. So, yeah, I mean, you have, on top of that, I'll just add one thing that, you know, maybe you shouldn't consider, but this is a gateway into the state and the country, and the presence of these turbines is a statement about that on a scenic byway. And I, you know, even though the Act doesn't talk in that kind of language, that's important. Going both ways, I could argue that either way. What can I say? I'd say let. I guess if I was to do one more, if I was to have you ask me a question, it would revolve around. There's this quote of mine where I say that the turbines are prominent, and that was asked of Gene too, I think. By prominent, I mean they're really visible. You can really see them. You can distinguish. You'll be able to see those blades turn at this distance. You know, at the six, eight miles, the blades are going to start to disappear. It's just going to be a tick mark. At the farther distance, you'll see a project, and the project will be important. They may be dominant, but in my mind, on Chain of Ponds, it's a marginal kind of level of dominance. I agree with Gene that what's going to be dominant is you're going to have these high peaks around you, and that sense of sort of a broad enclosure is what the dominant visual effect is going to be. But are they prominent? Yeah, there's a bunch of them. And you'll see, and if you're moving, if you're paddling, you're going to see them kind of rise up and fall down, you know, which could be interesting or horrible.
Your report was quoted earlier as saying that not only dominant but possibly predominant.
I think that
or predominant didn't possibly.
Yeah,
dominant.
Predominant though just means that that they're very visual.
Okay.
That it's not something that you can really hide. There's no pretension that it's something else. I've been with people looking at clear cuts, wondering if those are natural openings or not, if they're well designed. There's none of that's happening, right? Everybody understands that this is a constructed, man-made, not natural feature. They have to be noted. They have to be white. We don't have really much choice about that, unless you want more lights on them. You know, so they're there and clear, but that doesn't mean that. It's like when we talked about in Plum Creek, as you start developing a hillside, when does it change from a forested hillside to some kind of residential development? I'm not saying that this number of turbines being visible changes that ridgeline in the minds of whoever's looking at it into a power plant. I think it's still a forested hillside. And the area is predominantly forested hillside. I don't think that changes, but it's also big. I mean, there's no denying that. And the Act tells us that it's going to be big. I mean, they warned you right up front. There's no question these things are big. When you see them, they're going to have a big presence.
Can I interject here? We're running into scheduling issues.
Yeah.
And I guess let's move on and have Dave Roque give us...
Okay. I am Dave Roque, and the state soil scientist. My number one concern is protecting the natural hydrology. And the reason I focus there is I think it's one of the issues that's not been looked at or concentrated on much in the past. And obviously the natural hydrology affects everything down gradient. So that's where I've concentrated a lot of time. Number two would be erosion and sediment control. But that concern has been minimized by the use of blasted rock for the fill material because there's not much that moves there. And then number three would be minimizing impacts on protected natural resources such as streams, wetlands, vernal pools, ponds, And the reason that's down on the list for me is because there's a lot of other people keeping an eye on those things. And I tend to concentrate on the indirect impacts, again, like the hydrology impacts from upslope and what those might mean. As you all know, this is building roads up in high mountain areas is kind of uncharted territory. They were not, nobody allowed roads to be built up in those areas, so a lot of ideas were proposed, and some of the techniques were used that have turned out to work fairly well, such as the blasted rock and the rock sandwiches, which, you know, maybe you have some idea about now. I think the toolbox approach is very, very important for construction in these areas. One of the reasons is because, unlike lower elevations, you can't predict by vegetation and landforms where some of these measures are needed. You can do a very good job of predicting it in lower elevations, you can't in the mountains. So what's most important is the right thing gets used in the right place, not that it's shown on a plan and you put it in because a plan says it goes there. I've worked very closely with the third-party inspectors and the contractors to help educate them as to what kinds of measures are needed where. I try to go look at projects before they're developed, and then as the development takes place, so that everybody can sit around and discuss these issues and the right things can be done in the right places. And I think that's worked very well, because I try to look at them as a neutral a source, just technically. And I think it's worked so far fairly well. I've had 3 projects that I've done. I've got 2 for DEP I'm working on now, and they've worked pretty well.